This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. For many of us, the topic of self-care includes eating healthy and working out. But when you get busy, don't forget about your mental well-being as well. Therapy isn't for only those who've experienced a major trauma. For me, it's a tool to manage my stress and work on being the best version of myself.
So whether you are looking for a new therapist or trying therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is, well, here to help. Their online appointments are designed to be convenient for your schedule, and all you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can switch therapists at any time.
BetterHelp makes it easy to make your mental well-being part of your regular self-care regimen. So why not try BetterHelp? Take care of your body and your brain.
Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/dressed.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. But it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today. Dress the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when, and why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, today we thought it would be fun to play a bit of the alphabet game, but by way of the history of fashion, of course. And because we are both fashion history and word nerds, if you've listened to this show for the last 7 seasons, we are huge word nerds. So we thought it would be really fun and entertaining to explore some of the more unusual terms used for garments and textiles and accessories from the past, many or maybe even most of which we did not know before doing this episode. So learning fun all around.
Yes. And then if this concept seems familiar to you all, we did do one of these in the past and we got such a great response from it that we thought we would do another one. But this one is a little bit different. To make it even more fun, Cass and I are actually going to be trying to stump one another. And we have divided up the alphabet. We have done our research separately. Neither one of us know what the other person is going to say. And are we keeping a scorecard here, Cass?
Yes, possibly. We could totally do that. And dress listeners, feel free to keep your own scorecard and see how many of these you actually know. Okay, let's play fashion by the letter. April, your name starts with A, so it's only fitting that you go first. And of course, my name ends with Z, so easy way to divide it.
Okay, so my first term, and let me preface this with saying that you absolutely know this silhouette. You know what this is. Do you know what an Adrian gown refers to? Because I did not know this either.
An Adrian gown? No, I'm only familiar with Gilbert Adrian, the designer.
Yeah, and we're not talking about Gilbert Adrian, the designer. I'm going to give you perhaps a temporal clue, 18th century.
Nope, no idea.
Ah, so apparently Adrian gown is another name for a sack gown, aka a robe a la Française. And so our listeners, for any of you, think Marie Antoinette, think that very, you know, fitted bodice with the wide skirts worn over the panniers and that Watteau pleated back. Apparently another term for this is an Adrian gown.
Oh, super interesting.
Yeah, no, I saw that one. I was like, ooh, that's a good one.
I know there's so many words. It was actually hard for me to pick which ones I wanted to highlight, but I have done my best to narrow it down. So, dress listeners, April, we've all heard of this song, perhaps. Bombastic, Mr. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, I grew up in a cult, and contraband in most teenagers' rooms is like drugs or like pornography or something. The contraband in my room was fashion magazines and mixtapes.
Well, then maybe you've heard of the term bombast.
I do know what this is. It's a type of fabric.
Not quite. So,
is it a weave structure?
No. Many of us are probably familiar with the highly artificial shapes of the 16th century. So, think Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth, right? So, highly structured silhouettes, fashionable silhouettes. But have you ever wondered how the giant sleeves in, say, Queen Elizabeth's portrait kept their shape? Or how about those cod pieces worn by Henry VIII?
So, it's the padding,
yes,
within the codpiece or within the sleeve supporters.
Yeah, it's a type of filling or stuffing used to give structure to garments in the 16th and 17th centuries. And it could be made from everything from wool, cotton, horsehair, and even sawdust.
Oh, quite interesting. Yeah. Also, too, when women in the 18th century wearing their Adrian gowns, when the volume shifted from the panniers, which were kind of like basket-like structures at the sides of the hips, to the kind of bottom roll in the back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they used really unusual materials, like you just mentioned. Also, sometimes they used cork.
Yes, I am familiar with the cork rumps of the 18th century.
Yeah.
And just to word nerd a little bit, so the term bombast was first recorded at the turn of the 17th to the 18th century. And the word comes from the noun bombast, which means pompous and pretentious speak or words, but was first used in the English language around the mid-16th century, in reference to a type of padding that came from the bombax family of trees. So.
Oh, interesting. So it was relating to botany in some way.
Yeah. And I think a cotton tree is part of the bombax family of trees, and hence the term bombast being used for cotton.
That was very interesting. I just learned something. I feel like we're both going to learn things right alongside our listeners in this episode.
Oh, I learned so much. What do you got for me with a C, April?
Oh, that would be a cheat. And being you come from a theater and costume design background, you might know what this is, but do you know what a cheat was?
I feel like you've mentioned this before in terms of some type of ticket.
Not a ticket. It has two slightly different meanings within the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. So during the 17th and 18th century, it referred to a man's waistcoat, aka what we would now call a vest, that had the very expensive fabric on the front and cheaper fabric on the back. And that's because, of course, we've talked about on the show many times, textiles were incredibly valuable at this time. So if the gentleman, by way of etiquette and decorum, is always going to be wearing his jacket over his waistcoat or vest, why would you put the expensive fabric on the back? You don't. You just save it for the front. And this also parlays in a different sort of way into the 19th century when the term referred to a man's false shirt front. So the collar would be attached and it wouldn't be a full shirt. It didn't actually have sleeves. It just was the front of the shirt, like maybe what we would call a dickie.
Yes.
We actually did a fashion history mystery about years ago, remember? My mom used to make me wear them when I was a kid and horrified me. But yeah, so basically the cheat was a false shirt front that you could change every day. So it was like nice and clean, but you would have your, in the 19th century, you would have your vest and your jacket over it. So
is it have to do with cheating then? The art of the cheat because you're deceiving people as to the reality of your garment?
Yeah, but it was very widespread. This was like not necessarily a niche practice.
Super interesting.
Yeah. If we look at 19th century men's fashion advertising, you actually see them advertised. So it wasn't like something that was necessarily hidden.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something that was for use of economy. Maybe upper class men would have a fresh shirt every day. But maybe if you were like middle class, like lower class, you would use cheat and you would cheat.
Interesting.
Yeah. What about D?
D.
My middle name begins with a D.
Yes, April Dawn. So have you heard of Dolly Varden?
Well, I'm assuming this is some sort of a play on Dolly Parton.
No, but that's a great guess.
Can you spell it? Is it all one word?
No, Dolly Varden, V-A-R-D-E-N. And this might, some of our listeners actually might recognize this name, especially if you are a Charles Dickens fan, as she was a beguiling, flirtatious, and vibrantly dressed character from Dickens' 1841 historic novel, Barnaby Rudge, which was set in 1780. So this was actually a huge dress craze known as the Dolly Varden dress craze of the 1870s, specifically the year 1872, which is fascinating. And I have to give a shout out to historian and historical cons. Apparently, the Dolly Varden dress craze began after Dickens' death in 1868. And a few years after that, all his property was sold. And that included this Dolly Varden painting, which Natalie writes, quote, aroused enormous public interest. And so much so that by early 1872, the name Dolly Varden was being applied to all sorts of things, including a polka dance, a popular racehorse, and even a political party. And most notably for our audiences, of course, is its influence on fashion. Because the novel was set in the 1780s and the 1870s is the period of the bustle gown. The Polonaise gown that was popular during the 1780s was a really popular kind of application to the bustle gown, very similar silhouette, right? So the Polonaise of the 1780s was essentially an overskirt that was arranged in three swaths at the back of the skirt, supported by hoops. So it had this really bulbous effect. And I think it had something to do with the fact that Poland at the time, right, April, was divided into three states.
Political
or something.
History.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's super interesting, just intersection between politics and fashion. So it translated perfectly into these fashionable bustle silhouettes of the 1870s, notably those for day wear. They're often brilliantly colored after the characters' clothes. And they even led to fabric themselves earning this moniker of Dolly Varden. So things like brightly colored calicoes and Dolly Varden patterns. So it's just super, super interesting. And as a testament to the style's popularity in Vogue and Harper's Bazaar alone, it's mentioned 534 times.
Okay. What I was going to say is, if you all think that TikTok trends are like
new.
No. The things that are in fashion magazines from the 18th century are still the same things that people talk about today. Trends, acceleration of trends. This is nothing new. Humans at their core still are the same. They want to talk about the same things. They're interested in the same things.
They want to follow the fashion leaders. So
how things look and how the information about fashion was disseminated is different, but the people remain the same.
Yes. What do you have for E?
Oh, I would like to know.
We're 0 for 0, by the way.
We're off to Paris very soon, and I have been thinking quite a lot about packing because it's going to be fall when we are there. So usually we're there in summer. I would like to know, Cass, if you will be packing your eel skin mashers.
No, thank you.
No eel? No eel in your wardrobe. À Paris. Okay, so what are eel skin mashers? This has to do with dandy culture of the 1880s. So this is about a decade later than your Dolly Varden. They are apparently very, very exquisitely tight trousers worn by the dandies, who apparently sometimes were also known as mashers. I had never heard this term for dandyism before, because they were literally, the pants, the trousers were tight as an eel's skin.
Interesting. Okay, that's good. That's not where I saw that going. So I'm glad it's fabric and not eel skin, but that's...
No eels were harmed in
the making of these mashers.
Yeah, in the making of this eel skin masher trend. So that brings us to F.
F, have you heard of folly bells?
Nope.
Very short blurb here. I could not actually find that much information on these, but I loved the term folly. As we know, folly is often related to fashion throughout history. But so apparently these are decorative bells that were popular during the 15th century, often worn suspended from a girdle with chains by both men and women. And they served a decorative effect, but also a superstitious one as well, because they were believed to ward off evil spirits.
Okay.
Folly bells.
I think I've seen this in depictions, and these probably are not at all primary source depictions, But I think I've seen those in depictions of court gestures of that time period.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But they were also depicted just by like upper class portraits, et cetera.
Huh, okay. I'm going to look out for that in the history of art now. That's really interesting. So you have a toddler, and this next term has to do with children's wear. Do you know what a grow bag was?
No. I'm laughing because I have no idea what any of these things are. So
yeah. So this also relates to a kind of now anachronistic term, baby bunting. We don't really use that term anymore as well. That's more of a 19th century term. But essentially, these still exist, friends. It was a, quote, infant's outdoor combination blanket sack with a zipper front with a separate hood attached or detached, and can also be made with legs instead of a sack bottom. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is just an infant's onesie.
Yeah, it also reminds me of a sleep sack. Leo would sleep in a sleep sack, which doesn't have legs, but it's like a blanket for the little body.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly what this
what
is.
What period
so
is this
been word? Around from a really long time. This, in particular, grow bag was a 19th century term.
Interesting. So it has evolved.
And so it's like they're in their little sleep sack, and they can grow, and they can move around a little bit. But yeah.
Interesting. Have you heard of a hair shirt?
I have heard of them being a form of corporeal punishment. Like someone is sentenced to wear a hair shirt. Are they itchy? They're very itchy.
Yes. I think that is one form of it. So I would count this as April finally got one. It is a shirt or a loincloth made of horse hair and worn. I haven't read about it being worn for punishment, but for penance. Mm-hmm. So in Lourdes's class, this actually takes me back to grad school. Lourdes, who you've heard us talk about so many times on the show, teaches
Lourdes Font.
Lourdes Font, a wonderful history of fashion course at FIT in New York. And we had to dissect the fashions on view in a famous historic portrait. Everybody was assigned one portrait. And I was given Hans Holbein the Younger's 1527 portrait of Sir Thomas More, which has since become one of my favorite portraits in fashion history, especially because I've seen it up close at the Frick in New York. And you would not believe how meticulously and realistically imitated the velvet on his sleeves are. It literally looks like you can reach out and touch the sleeves.
That's it.
So it's so exquisite. But my examination of this portrait actually took me to very unexpected places, because what I made the subject of my presentation was not what you could see in the image, but something that you could not see. Again, the assignment was to explain what the wearer was wearing. And I found out in my research on Thomas More that underneath his layers, his getting dressed every day would have involved him first putting on a hair shirt. So it was meant to be uncomfortable, and he wore it next to the skin for penance, which is just, it's very interesting. Pieces of it survive because if you don't know who Thomas More is, he was an English statesman, humanist, author, also a devout Catholic who lost his head to King Henry VIII's despotism, but was much later canonized as a saint. So a piece of his hair shirt survives as part of a relic associated with him.
Where's that?
Yeah, exactly. So there you go, dress listeners, a hair shirt.
So I guess when I said I've heard it in the context of punishment, I guess I mean penance. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
self-penance.
It's a different context.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder if also people were sentenced to wearing a hair shirt as well. I think that might have also been a thing as well.
Probably maybe within the context of the Catholic Church. Yeah, I'm not sure though.
Yeah, the Inquisition and Catholic guilt et al.
Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Your cash back really adds up. Cass, did you know that learning a new language is only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, Dress listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dress listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st. Okay, Cass, I know for a fact that you have engaged many times in this next term.
Okay.
Do you know what inchering is?
Inchering?
Inchering, like I-N-C-H-E-R-I-N-G. The verb of inching.
No,
it is an 18th century term for taking the measurements of a person in order to make or fit a garment.
Interesting.
Inchering.
How inchering?
Yeah. Working in film and TV, I'm sure you inchered so many people.
I have inchered a lot of people, and now I'm going to start using that and see how many people look at me.
Askance.
Okay, I actually do think you've probably heard of this next term, but I didn't know. I've never really considered it within this context or history that I'm going to talk about. Do you know what a justacorp is?
Yes, I do. It is a transitional garment. So late 17th, early 18th century, that was like a transitional upper torso garment for men that spanned from the doublet to the waistcoat or vest.
Almost.
Okay.
But you're right about it being a transitional garment, just not about the silhouette. So it's a long fitted knee-length button front coat with a full skirt that replaced shorter doublets. So moving out of the shorter doublet era of the 16th and early 17th century, yes. So it's definitely a transitional garment, but it's more of a coat. And it really becomes like, if you look at 17th century, early 18th century men's fashion, that's the silhouette you associate with those eras. It also has a full skirt, I believe I said, and it becomes the dominant form of male garment in this era. And what I had never considered is that it was actually made popular by King Charles II of England, who, if you know about his history, and we've certainly talked about him before on the podcast, really important. Historians track the origin of the modern three-piece suit to King Charles II of England in 1666, I believe.
He was adopting a form of Persian dress.
Yes, inspired by similar styles worn in Persia. And what makes this unique is he wore this justacorp with a waistcoat or vest for us in America. And again, as I said, by pairing these three garments, he also made it regulatory to wear, or he certainly inspired other men to adopt this form of dress. He was really trying to get away from the ostentation of fashion at that time. And so he was really hoping people would adopt a more uniform, simple appearance. And so this is really cited as the origin of the three-piece suit that would dominate men's wardrobes for centuries thereafter. So there you go. The justicorps.
Yep. I knew it was like that weird transitional menswear time period situation.
Yes, absolutely. I think you're a 2 for 0 on me.
Oh, you're going to give me that one? Okay, maybe I get 1.5.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the 1960s Cass are one of your areas of interest as a fashion historian. And I will give you a heads up that this dates to this time period. And like our last term relates to menswear. Do you know what a kipper was? And I don't mean like the little fish that sometimes people eat like a sardine.
No idea.
It's a necktie. And think of like the neckties of the late 1960s, early 1970s. You know how they get super wide at the bottom? So a kipper was a necktie where the base that had the pointed ends reached about 4 to 5 inches wide. So it's like those super duper crazy neckties of the late 1960s, early 1970s. And typically they were made in a very loud striped or pattern fabric. And that is what a kipper was.
Interesting. Yes, of course, the 60s is a period of the male peacock revolution. That's a nice transition out of the justicorp, actually, because we always talk about the great male renunciation of the early 19th century, where men gave up their right to be beautiful, adopted that uniform standard suit that it had been developing for a century. And really, it became societally unacceptable for men to embrace that decorative element of fashion. But the 1960s brought it all out again, which is always super fun and exciting to learn about. So the kipper sounds like it's definitely part of that culture.
Okay, what do you have next?
Yes, so another menswear term. And actually,
we're doing so much menswear today.
Yeah, and I think actually this is a more common term. And so you probably have heard of it. But again, the history that I learned about this fashion trend is super fascinating. So have you heard of a lovelock?
Yes. So that would be a 17th century little hair situation that men had. And it was a little bit of a curlicue thing that they would wear at the base of their neck.
Yes. So the lovelock I speak of is, as April Mitch just mentioned, it started in the late 16th century, went into the 17th century. It's a men's hair fad in which they wore a long lock of braided hair hanging over the chest as an emblem of love and devotion, hence the title. So apparently it was hanging close to their heart. It was just on the one side. And this is a period when men wore their hair very long and full. And so that was an extension of that.
And is it like a sign of I'm taken?
I don't know, but it's definitely speaking as an emblem of your love for someone. So my guess is yes, but it was also just a fashion trend of the period. And something that I found fascinating about this lovelock is that it actually proved quite a point of contention for religious conservatives who found any ostentatious display of fashion immoral and ungodly. And this holds especially true for Puritans, like the moralist William Prynne, who wrote not one, but 2 treatises on the topic, including 1628's The Unloveliness of Lovelocks, or a summary discourse proving the wearing and nourishing of a lock or lovelock to be altogether unseemly and unlawful unto Christians. And yes, that was the title, the full title of the treatise.
Every period. I said this on the podcast the other day when I can't remember who I was talking to. Oh, it was Joe. I was talking to Joe Weldon. I was like, all the moralists, they're always there. They always have a lot to say about fashion.
Yes. And usually it's about women's fashion. So this is really fascinating. And again, in 1646, almost 20 years later, he's still lamenting the style. He's writing about it in another pamphlet called A Gauge for Long-Haired Rattleheads Who Revile All Civil Roundheads, which is so interesting. But again, while I'd certainly heard of lovelocks prior to doing research for today's episode, I did learn something in my research that is particularly interesting, especially in relationship to our recent episodes on Indigenous fashion history. So something I learned is that lovelocks were actually inspired by and worn in imitation of Native American hairstyles. specifically the asymmetrical hairstyles worn by Powhatan men. So apparently Pocahontas's husband, John Rolfe, commented on this influence, as did others. And one source even cited it coming to England via the returning survivors of the Roanoke colony in 1586. So American history buffs, if that is one of the very first, if not the first, American colonies or British colonies, British American colonies in the U.S., it failed horribly. And so apparently the survivors that returned had the Lovelock hairstyle, or what would become the Lovelock hairstyle. So just another example of how pervasive and influenced Indigenous fashion has had historically that often doesn't get its due.
And also an example of fashion trickling up.
Yes, exactly. Right?
Yeah, it happens all the time. Wow, that's like super interesting. I feel like we might need an entire mini.
I know. Well, I was thinking even just that title, The Unloveliness of Lovelocks, is a great title. So maybe it will be in a future episode.
And there's so much more to unpack about that for sure. Okay, I'm going to take us to an entirely different direction, but I'm going to cite us in the 19th century all around. Cass, do you know what a Matilda was in the 19th century? It has to do with women's fashion.
Is it a type of coat?
Not a type of coat. It has a couple different meanings. Very interesting. It could either be a velvet decoration around the hem of a woman's skirt, or very, very specifically in the 1840s, a bouquet of flowers worn in a woman's hair.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I wonder who it's named
decorative,
after.
Decorative
floral
embellishment.
Embellishment.
Floral embellishment, probably around your skirt or maybe in your hair. But yeah, there was a lot of that in the 19th century for sure. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't find any information about who it might possibly refer to. But of course, also in the 1840s, that very specific 1840s bodice style that kind of had the puckers and fold over at the top was called a bertha.
Mm-hmm.
So they were giving these fashion trends or silhouettes women's names. At the time.
Oh, yeah. Something we will get to here in a little bit. One of my terms
great.
As well.
Amazing.
Yes, very common.
What's next?
So have you heard of a 9/10 coat?
Oh, I have not.
So a 9/10 coat is a women's A-line coat reaching to or just below the knee, popular in the 1960s, but I've actually found reference to them beginning in 1929 Vogue, which appeared to be a similar straight style. It's often worn with a matching dress. So very ubiquitous during the 1960s, especially. I have no idea where it got its name. I could not find like an origin point or even anything that tried to explain it. But yeah, it's called a 9/10 coat, which I thought was fascinating.
So would the hem of the dress, depending on what point in the 60s we're talking about and how fashionable one was, would the hem of the dress be slightly longer than the 9/10 coat? So it's like the coat is just slightly longer than the hem of the skirt?
I don't think so.
Dress or skirt?
I don't think so. It was interesting. Picture I saw, it was about the same length as the skirt. So
interesting.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means. Maybe it's just implying that it's not a 10th coat would reach the ground, and maybe a 9/10 coat reaches your knee. I'm not sure.
Listeners, maybe some of you know more about this than we do. So if you do, hit us up.
Share.
Okay, I'm going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and this is a pun intended. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that a lot of our listeners out there have worn the next term, which is owl glasses. You know what those were?
Owl glasses. I have no idea.
Oversized, extra large sunglasses, which have a very heavy rim, which give an impression of a surprised owl.
From the 80s?
I don't know. I think this is more of a 60s term. Like those big, very kooky sunglasses.
Yeah.
I had never heard this term before either. So, I'm like, oh, I think I own a few pair of those.
Yes, definitely comes in and out of fashion. So, speaking of material culture of fashion, especially smaller items, I have no idea where this fascination comes from. But if you've listened to the show for a while, you know that I am obsessed with miniature or small things. And again, this is probably something people have heard of. It's not super obscure, but April, do you know what a pomander is?
Yes, I do. This is one I definitely do. So pomanders were worn late Middle Ages into the Renaissance, and it was like a little sphere that held scented materials And oftentimes women in particular wore them on little chain around their belt. So when they would go out into public with maybe like ill smelling situations, that it would scent the air.
Yes. Again, I knew you would know it and it's not necessarily obscure, but these are just so fascinating to me. As you said, these little small spheres of gold or silver, they can be quite elaborate, inset with gemstones, decorated, filled with any number of fragrant herbs or flowers. You know, at a time when bathing wasn't a priority or they actually thought it could be hazardous to your health, these kind of scents, there's even pictures with women holding them up to their nose or keeping them in their vicinity. A number of them survive in museum collections. They're depicted in numerous portraits of the era. And again, just one of those fascinating aspects of material culture that we don't necessarily have today anymore. I guess we wear our perfume more than we do actually hold it, but I just find them incredibly lovely.
Yeah, these are really great. And also too, going back to that topic that I mentioned earlier of people's interests or things don't really change that much. This is just aromatherapy, friends.
Yeah,
we exactly. We just call it something different now.
Dress listeners, we have had so much fun with you today, and there are still so many more letters that we did not get to. So we are going to be bringing this to you in a part two where we continue this conversation and this contest that April is clearly already winning on Friday. Until then, dress listeners, may you consider the A to Z of your wardrobe next time you get dressed.
Remember, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com, or you can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is, of course, where you'll find reels and posts accompanying each week's episodes. If you'd like to find content for this week's episodes, which is going to be a two-parter, that can be found at #dress508 and #dress509. We get so many questions from you all about our recommendations for fashion history books. So if you're interested, you can always find a link in our show notes to our bookshop bookshelf. So that address is bookshop.org/shop/dressed. And there you can find over 150 of our favorite fashion history titles.
You can also find a link to that in our show notes, where you can find a link to dressedhistory.com, which of course is our website, where you can check out our latest offerings from the Dress Universe. That includes our classes and our tours. So head on over to dressedhistory.com and see what we have up our sleeves.
Also, you can find out more information about my Fashion History Fridays at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. There you can join me for a 90-minute tour of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world all the way into the 20th century. And just teeny little heads up, friends, my Met tours in NYC are going to be on pause until late November. You can pick me up late November and into 2025. In the intervening weeks, I'll be in Paris, and I might just have some Parisian things up my sleeve there as well. But I'll keep you all posted.
Love Dress but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to our ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month and enjoy our 8 new episodes a month ad-free. That does it for us today, Dress listeners. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more Dress coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.